WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, offering a master's degree in clinical mental health counseling. Work as a licensed professional counselor or mental health and wellness advocate. Details are available at uwp.edu. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to be spending the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show talking about something which is a part of the lives of approximately 1% of the population, stuttering. And of course, stuttering is something that we are talking about perhaps a bit more than we have in the past, because our own president, that is President Joe Biden, is someone who is a stutterer. And, of course, he's many other things, but stuttering is something that has been a part of his life and is one of the very compelling parts of his story is what this has meant for him and the lessons that he has learned. Well, my guest on today's morning show is also someone who stutters. His name is Sander Flaum, and he has written a book about this, which is called The Stutter Steps, Proven Pathways to Speaking Confidently and Living Courageously. And in this book, Sander Flaum talks not only about what has been helpful to him, but other methods by which people have sought to come to terms with their stuttering, in some cases to bring it under control, and in some cases learning to fully accept it and even to celebrate it. In other words, there are a number of different pathways involved in stuttering, and the author contends that there is not one magic pill that or one size fits all. So I appreciate the fact that his book takes such a comprehensive view of this important issue. Again, the book is titled The Stutter Steps, Proven Pathways to Speaking Confidently and Living Courageously. The author is a former chair of the board of directors for the AIS, the American Institute for Stuttering. Sander A. Flaum, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you for having me on.
I really appreciate this opportunity to speak with you. Tell our listeners, first of all, at what point in your own life stuttering became a part of your speech. Can you trace that back to the very beginning?
Sure. Well, I was a stutterer as a kid. Most of the time, it usually goes away by the time you're, 5 or 6 years old. Most of the time it just goes away, but it's tough. Yeah. Your caregivers, your parents, your friends do not focus on speech. It goes away. Both of my children, as a matter of fact, stuttered. It drove me nuts. Went to a speech therapist, and he said, Sander, just do not discuss speech with them, and it will just go away. And you know what? It did. So thank God for that. They both are very fluent speakers. But one of the things that is very interesting, Craig, that we found out about 5 years ago, a study by the NIH, a gentleman named Dr. Dennis Drainer, working with Dr. Ron Webster at the Holland Communications Research Institute, where I got my chemotherapy, did years of study and ascertained that stuttering is a genetic illness. Yeah, this is very, very recent and not well known, but Winston Churchill, a stutterer. His grandmother was a stutterer. And when you look at stuttering, Emily Blunt, who is our MC at the American Institute for Stuttering, no matter where she is in the world, she comes in to MC our gala every year. And her father was a stutterer. And with the story with Emily Blunt, very interesting, a wonderful actress, as we all know, Mary Poppins, and she was great in that. In high school, her teacher wants her in a play. And Emily said, I'm a stutterer. I can't do it. I won't do it. Emily, you're going to be in the play. And Emily was in the play, but change your voice, and guess what? With the change of voice in the play, she didn't stutter. And that's Emily's story. But when you're with Emily, I know Emily, one-on-one, you will sometimes hear these fluencies. And, President Biden, as we all know, is a stutterer. And 5 years ago, in fact, he was our guest of honor at the American Institute for Stuttering. And just to paraphrase what he said there, I'm quoting him, it is critically important not to judge ourselves by our speech and not let our speech define us, unquote. So for those who stutter and their loved ones can fully grasp this concept, they're well on their way to triumph.
One of the most interesting principles that you explore in your book, The Stutter Steps, is that for many people, their means of dealing with their stuttering is to engage in various avoidance methods. That is to live their lives and to change their speech and the circumstances under which they speak in order to eliminate their stuttering as much as possible, which at a glance might seem like a great thing to do, and maybe for some people it is the right choice. But you actually begin your book with a chapter devoted to avoidance reduction therapy, which is actually a means, I think, to get somebody who stutters to not engage in some of these avoidance methods. Explain why this could potentially be a positive thing for somebody to do, for somebody who is stuttering.
Greg, there are different organizations. The American Institute for Stuttering, of which I served as chairman for 4 years, it's okay to stutter. I mean, their therapy is, it's okay to stutter. The program I went to, Holland Communications Research Institute, when I was in my early 30s, no, it's not okay to stutter. You are taught there through a very intensive 3-week program, Greg, how to pronounce words and sounds in a different way, like B's, G's, D's, S's, sounds that are difficult for stutterers. Matter of fact, I was a baseball player back in high school days, and I couldn't get Sandy out, S. My middle name was Allen. I called myself Allen Slime back then, which was so difficult. But there were different methods, different ways. But the American Institute for Stuttering, it's okay to stutter. As a matter of fact, I taught the graduate students for them for 16 years. And opening class, I said, look, I don't care how you say it. It's what you say that I'm really interested in. You can have a disfluency, like me. I'm a stutterer. I got it out the first class. Or you can have an accent. I don't care. It's what you say, not how you say it. So that takes the pressure off when you get out and say, I'm a stutterer. And, you know, it's perfectly okay to do it. And, you know, you obviously Joe Biden, he was say, talks about it a lot. As a matter of fact, you know, what he said that when he spoke to my group, the American Institute of Stuttering, he recalled his mother's encouragement. And let me quote. This is what he said. Joey, this is his mom. Joey, don't let this define you. Remember who you are, Joey. You can do it. And unquote. My mother used different words with me, but it's essentially the same message. Keep moving forward, Sandra Allen. Don't let this get you down. And she always, in her advice, she was a great mentor to me, a great leader. My mom said, look, you're a stutterer. If you're going to interview with two fluent speakers as you get older, you're not getting a job. But what you need to do as a stutterer, you just have to work harder and be smarter. And kind of that's been the story of my life. So, you know, we did that all my career. I worked for a big pharmaceutical company for a long time. Was able to, I don't know, you may have read this in the book. I read it for a long, long time. I grew the vaccine division to number one in the world, the oncology division to number one in the world, but didn't get the big job. I couldn't understand that I was way ahead of my colleagues. So after, believe it or not, 18 years to level the laboratories, I left and got recruited to an advertising agency in Manhattan, French-owned, called Havas. And finally, you know, one day on a Christmas Eve that year, Christmas Eve was snowing like crazy, and a former senior vice president, George Bywater, called and said, Sandra, I need to see you for lunch up here. I said, George, I'd love to see you, but, you know, it's snowing like crazy. It's Christmas Eve. And I don't, you know, I have prostate cancer. I'm not quite sure how much longer I have. So please. So got in the car, drove in the blinding snowstorm to Nanuet, New York, Route 59, hung lock, where there was the martini lunch every day. Back then, there was a martini lunch. There was a martini waiting for me. I had a sip of that. I said, Sandra, the reason I needed to see you is that I don't know how much longer I have. I'm in stage 4 prostate cancer. I want to tell you why you didn't get the big job. Okay, I finished that martini, and I'm not a drinker, by the way, right? There was another martini coming. He said, look, one of the members of the board said stuttering is a manifestation of mental illness, and you can't give Sandra the job. And I said, thank you, George. Drank the second martini. Gave George a hug, by the way. He did pass away 6 months after that. Got in the car, drove back to Manhattan in a blinding snowstorm, and said, you know what? I'm just going to be more successful than anybody there. And we were able to grow this advertising agency to number 2 in the world. After, you know, 15 years there, to number 2 in the world. And that was it. So it was always been work harder and be smarter. My mom's advice.
We're speaking with Sander A. Flaum about his book, The Stutter Steps, Proven Pathways to Speaking Confidently and Living Courageously. In his book, he chronicles not only what he has done in terms of dealing with his stuttering, but but outline some other methods which are out there, which can be a part of this. Sandra Flom, do we understand why a given person stutters, or is that still something of a mystery? And is it also possible that different people stutter for different reasons?
Well, the research, which is new, and not many people speak about it, it's a genetic thing. My uncle, a brilliant composer, arranger, was a stutterer. Emily Blunt's dad was a stutterer. And that's it. But this is all new research. It's only 5 years old.
Right.
You never see it written about a lot, but it's a genetic thing.
Right. But in a given person, when they are stuttering, what is going on inside their mind or inside their mouth or both? Or is that still something that we're still trying to understand? What is actually going on in the moment that causes a given person to stutter? Or does that vary greatly from person to person?
It's just a natural thing. I mean, it's natural. You've been stuttering since you're a kid. So it just comes very, very naturally. It's very difficult. I still remember as a young man going to the movies with my friend, a double feature, and in between the double feature, there was the cartoon, Walter Lantz, Porky Pig. And if you remember Porky Pig, that's all, folks. Everyone started to laugh in the theater. My friend just, kind of looked at me out of the corner of their eye. And, well, everyone else was laughing hysterically. Finally, thank God, the cartoon Porky Pig was pulled because it hurt stuttery so much to hear this.
So for you, what has proven to be the most significant help in terms of you gaining as much fluency as you have? I mean, in the course of this conversation, in the course of 15 minutes, there's been scarcely a hint that stuttering is part of your life. For you, what has made the difference?
Well, that's a very good question. Before we had this particular interview, I did meditate. Meditation is something very important. I learned it from my son, who was a former Buddhist monk, meditation. So I did meditation before our broadcast. And the lessons I learned at Holland's Communications Research Institute in Roanoke, Virginia, is slow, comfortable breath when you speak. Stutterers tend to speak on exhale breath. Holland, I was there for 3 intensive weeks, morning till night. It's a slow, comfortable, full breath, and you tend to do your sounds differently. The different sounds for stutterers, I'd say B, G, S, are tough sounds, but Holland teaches you how to say, instead of Sander. So it's a slow S, soft S, Sander. Not Sander. Sander Flom. But that's what we have. That's what we learn at Holland's. I went there with Andy Glenn, by the way, John Glenn's former wife. They both passed away recently. Yes. John Stossel from Fox News is there with me. And we all got the same lessons.
One of the interesting techniques that you also share in your book is something called stuttering modification, which creates something which is sometimes called easy stuttering, a kind of retraining that can make a difference. Can you just explain what this is?
Well, that's basically what I just discussed with you, Greg. you know you're a stutterer, and if you practice with a slow, comfortable, full breath before a speech, you're going to be okay. As long as you are focused on the slow, comfortable, full breath, and stay focused on sounds that stutterers have difficulty with. You know, the heart, the G, D, F, B. You say it, you know, in a totally different way. You know, believe me. It's not believe me. Believe me. So I said that with a full breath, and that's what we're taught to do. That's it.
There's also a point in the book when the point is made that sometimes purposeful stuttering or voluntary stuttering can actually make a difference. That is where someone who finds themselves often stuttering and in a sense involuntarily stuttering can gain some measure of control over it by sometimes choosing to stutter on purpose. Explain what the thought is behind this.
Well, you know, being a stutterer, at times, you know, there are different points of view. There are very many different stuttering organizations, Greg. And, you know, one of them, the American Stuttering Institute, is perfectly okay to stutter. And they encourage it. You know, it's perfectly okay to stutter. There's nothing wrong with you if you do stutter. As long as you do your job the right way, that's it. So there are different viewpoints on stuttering out there, Greg.
I also want to touch on the matter that comes up in Chapter 9 about how for some people, like, for instance, the aforementioned actress Emily Blunt, and for the singer like Ed Sheeran, that sometimes what has made the biggest difference for them is simply engaging in, for instance, acting for Emily Blunt or singing for Ed Sheeran. And I read this with great interest, especially because I happen to be a voice teacher, and I have recently had a voice student who was a stutterer in speech, but whose stuttering pretty much vanished whenever he engaged in singing. So so these stories are particularly interesting, I think.
Yes. And Ed Sheeran was terrific at our job. He was really wonderful. Very open about his stuttering. You know, and he did, you know, when you spoke to Ed before he got on stage, you heard some disfluencies. And he was wonderful. He gave a talk about his life as a stutterer. And after the speech, he pulled me aside, wrote me a check for $10,000. He said, Sam, I don't want anyone to know about this, but I want to donate this check for the young people who need stage therapy but can't afford it. And that was Ed Sheeran. And got back on a plane and flew back to Ireland. But and that was Ed Sheeran, a marvelous human being. Emily Blunt, same way. No matter where she is in the world, no matter where she is, films, whatever shows, she gets on a plane and comes to MC our gala every year. She's just a special, special person.
I want to finish with one of the most remarkable points made in the whole book, which is that there is something to be gained by actually taking pride in the fact that one stutters. In order to really look at it as positively as possible rather than something that is only a negative which must be eliminated or hidden away for one reason or another or by one way or another. And, and it sounds like this is something that you believe as well, that embracing the fact that one stutters can make a huge difference. Tell us more about this.
Well, I think, you know, now that we have President Biden as a model, and I'm sure many of our listeners saw the interview with Biden and a young boy who does stutter, he did it on TV, who does stutter, and how he worked with this young boy, telling him how he overcame it, And but he still does stutter. If we remember during the campaign, some of the other candidates on stage kind of made fun of when he had a block. He did have several blocks during the debate. But well, he told the young boy, look, I mean, I've been a stutterer all of my life. It never sticked in my way. I always was able to overcome it. Because, like you know, his mom said, Joey, don't let this stop you from doing what you need to do. And that's been his life, always. That's been his life. And, you know, who went through more hardships than Joe Biden, you know, losing a wife in a car accident, his son to bring cancer. But Joe Biden has always moved ahead, always moved ahead. And that's the lesson, Greg, we want for stutterers in this book, that you always have to move ahead, no matter how tough this day may have been. You've had some major difficulties. You're a stutterer, and you just have to move ahead. And as Rose Flown, my mom said, you're going to have to work harder and be smarter. And that's been my life, too, harder and smarter.
That reminds me of the motto for the American Institute for Stuttering, the motto which is speak freely, live fearlessly. And I suppose that's maybe the central message of your book, that more than anything for somebody who stutters, you do not want them to be afraid of speaking or afraid of living, or afraid of living a full life.
Well said, Greg. Well said, yes.
The book again is The Stutter Steps, Proven Pathways to Speaking Confidently and Living Courageously. And the author is Sander A. Flaum. The last name is spelled F-L-A-U-M. Mr. Flaum, I really appreciate this opportunity to speak with you on our program about your important book and the important work that you and others are doing on this important issue. Thank you so much, and best wishes to you.
Thank you for having me, Greg, very much.
You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show Archive. Well, as someone who owns and loves two golden retrievers, I am a dog lover from way back, and so it is with special pleasure that I am welcoming to this portion of The Morning Show someone who is also a dog lover, a woman by the name of Nancy Furstinger, who is also a highly acclaimed author and editor of children's books and responsible for a wonderful new book that has just been published by National Geographic, primarily intended for young readers, but just about anybody is going to be inspired by this book called Paws of Courage, True Tales of Heroic Dogs That Protect and Serve. In this book, Nancy Furstinger highlights the inspiring stories of more than 20 different work dogs or service dogs who have done work of one kind or another to make the world a better place. And in particular, she focuses on military and law enforcement dogs who, in a sense, face great peril and often make a very, very dramatic difference for the better in very, very difficult situations. And I'm really happy to have Nancy Furstinger with me on the phone to talk about this book, which is her first book for National Geographic. Nancy Furstinger, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you so much. And I, too, am very passionate about dogs. I have two rescued dogs myself. And I was really thrilled to profile these 22 dogs that star in Paws of Courage. And it was incredible the number of jobs that they do, because you probably know that dogs' noses are far superior than human noses. They are 10,000 times more powerful, Dogs can even detect 1 teaspoon of sugar in an Olympic-sized swimming pool. So that's amazing.
Right. What they can do is really, really something. I know that you not only have dogs, but I think you have other animals as well. I mean, you are not just a dog lover, but an animal lover. Just give our listeners a sense of just who lives at your home.
Well, I have a 130-pound Rottweiler named Bosco, who's just a big mush. I have a rescued lab shepherd, Rhodesian Ridgeback Hound mix, who comes from North Carolina, Rosie. And then I have a quartet of rescued house rabbits who mostly come from the local SPCA, where I volunteer with the rabbits primarily.
Mm-hmm. Well, you obviously not only love animals, but you love writing. And in particular, you seem to have spent most of your professional energies on helping to develop and edit children's books. Can you just say a quick word about where that interest came from?
Yes, actually, I was an editor at Simon & Schuster for 3 different imprints that are now all defunct, unfortunately. But I read a couple of books, in particular, one by Fergie, the Duchess, and it was really awful, and I challenged myself to write a better book, and that's how I started out. And I slowly became known as an author who specializes in animal topics, which, as you can probably tell, are my passion. So most of my books are animal subjects, particularly this one, which National Geographic actually approached me and asked me if I would write a book about hero dogs. And that was the tentative title of the book, but I'm sure you agree that Paws of Courage is a much more appealing title.
Oh, I think it's great. By the way, I've seen 2 different indications of just how young a reader this book is intended for. One place I saw that it was for readers 10 and up, but someplace else it was indicated as for readers 5 and up. And not that those specifics necessarily matter, but it prompts the question of what sort of a reader were you thinking about as you wrote this book, and how tricky is it to craft a book that that a lot of different young readers are going to be able to understand and appreciate and enjoy?
That's a great question. The ages 10 and up is the correct specification from National Geographic, and of course, a lot of adults also enjoy this book, but this book is geared toward reluctant readers because it's got brief text and short chapters. It's easy to manage, a lot of action photos. So I'm hoping that a lot of young males who don't particularly enjoy books will pick it up. But it's a whole different story if you craft a book for, say, a 5-year-old, which I have 2 picture books, both about animals as well. The text is much briefer, usually 1,000 words or less, a couple of sentences per page, and it's very heavily influenced by the artwork or, in some cases, photographs. Which this book, being a National Geographic book, their hallmark is fantastic action photos, which I think they've really captured in this book.
We're speaking with Nancy Furstinger, and we're talking about her book, Paws of Courage, True Tales of Heroic Dogs That Protect and Serve. This is a book for young readers primarily, although anybody of just about any age is going to enjoy this book on some different level. And this is Nancy Furstinger's first book for National Geographic. So give our listeners some sense of the array of jobs that a work dog can do. I mean, and it goes beyond sort of the obvious or the most noteworthy, which most people have probably heard at least a little bit about. Give us a sense of what that array of possibilities, in fact, is, and how much of that scope is covered in your book.
Yes, I'll be happy to. As I said, dogs' noses are 10,000 times more powerful than humans, which they can sniff out practically anything with those noses. Some of them become explosive detection dogs overseas in Iraq and Afghanistan. Others you might have seen at an international airport. They sniff out food and drugs and other illegal contraband. Other canine companions that are paired with police officers are great at apprehending suspects. Dogs can go to a training program up in Maine that an insurance company started to detect the accelerants used in arson, such as gasoline. And then I have some dogs that do jobs that you would never think of. One in particular in Italy jumps out of helicopters to rescue swimmers in distress along the coast. Two in Africa help track down poachers who are hunting African elephants. There's dogs that sniff out invasive species such as pythons in the Everglades. Other dogs that sniff out tiger scat to track down, rare species that need protection. It just goes on and on. Bed bugs, they can sniff out cancer. They can smell when someone is about to have an epileptic seizure. I could go on for another 5 minutes.
Wow, it's really amazing. When it comes to a particular task, I mean, one of those tasks that you just enumerated, are we typically talking about a certain breed of dog that is especially well-suited for that particular task? Or typically could just about any breed of dog handle just about any of these various tasks that you were just listing?
Oh, that's a great question. I think the most preferred dog overseas to become a military working dog is the Belgian Malinois, like Leica, who stars on the cover. They look like smaller versions of German Shepherds, and these are the canine superheroes. They're combined speed, strength, and courage. Police dogs are still primarily German Shepherds because they're loyal and confident. And search and rescue dogs are retrievers, like your golden retrievers. They're intelligent, energetic, and strong. The dogs that you see in airports are usually smaller with a great nose, such as a beagle. And for the arson dogs, I found this really fascinating. The insurance company that trains these dogs to sniff out accelerants rescues these dogs from shelters, and they go into the shelters and they look for primarily lab and lab mixes, and they're looking for the dogs that bounce off the walls with excess amount of energy, because they harness that high energy and they direct it into the job. So it's a great program because they rescue a lot of dogs that would otherwise, you know, not have a chance at getting a home.
You're touching on already on the next question I wanted to ask, which is, for instance, when there is a task to be done and one has a sense of a particular breed that is especially ideal, let's say, for instance, a golden retriever who might be engaged in you know, kind of a search and rescue sort of thing. Once we know that that's the task and we probably want a golden retriever or some kind of retriever to do that, then what difference is there between, for instance, various golden retrievers or black labs or whatever we might be looking at, in terms of particular dogs who would be especially good at this particular sort of work? I mean, are there certain things that one would want to look for?
Well, they want a dog who's very enthusiastic about the task they're about to perform, and one with the right personality. For instance, I can tell you a little bit about Brittany, who is a golden retriever who is in the book and was recently in a lot of news stories your listeners might have heard. She was the last remaining 9/11 dog, and she had three careers in her life. She trained to become a search and rescue dog because she had the right temperament and she was very energetic. And she was about 2 years old when she and her handler, Denise Corliss, went on their first search and rescue deployment. And this was baptism by fire because it was 9/11, the very first time she went out on the job. And unfortunately, she wasn't able to do what she was trained for, search and rescue. But she noticed a firefighter sitting there very dejected with his head in his hands. And she tugged Denise over and put her head in his lap to cheer him up. And she instantly transformed into a therapy dog. So during the entire 2 weeks she was there in Manhattan, she offered comfort to people. And she had a great personality, like most golden retrievers. She was confident and calm in stressful situations. And she did end up working a lot of search and rescues, including Hurricane Katrina. And then she became older, and she transformed once again into another job. She became a reading dog with first graders. She went into schools and had first graders read books to her, because a lot of kids are not confident readers and they don't want to read a book in front of their peers, but they'll gladly read a book to a handsome dog. And earlier this month, she passed away. She was the last 9/11 dog, and she was nearly 17, which is quite an amazing age for a golden retriever.
Wow, that's quite a story. What kind of training
incredible is
involved in getting a dog ready to do some of these challenging tasks? And once a dog has been trained, are they sort of trained in perpetuity, or do dogs, in a sense, need to have that training refreshed through the course of the time that they are doing the work?
Well, that's a good question. It really depends on the task that they're being trained to do. For instance, a lot of these military working dogs are trained overseas in Israel or other places by professional dog trainers, whereas search and rescue dogs are trained on simulated rubble piles here. And what I found out, which was really amazing, is that one of the top rewards for training a dog is a Kong toy on a rope. And in case your listeners aren't familiar, it's a big rubber toy with a hollow in the middle that you can stuff with peanut butter. It bounces, it floats. Dogs just love it. So they use that as a reward for the dogs to find explosives, and that's how they initially train the dog. They have the scent of the explosive in the Kong, and once the dog associates the scent with the Kong, he knows he'll get his reward afterwards, playtime. So then they gradually transition over and just have the scent by itself, and then the dog is rewarded with the Kong. And they use this also for dogs who detect accelerants for arson. Very similar situation. So I also found out that there's two types of an alert these dogs are trained to give. For instance, if a dog is apprehending a criminal and sniffs out drugs in the car, the dog will dig and paw at the car. The paint chips will fly. But obviously, that's not a good way to alert if a dog sniffs out a bomb. So in that instance, it could be disastrous. He will just sit and point his nose toward where the bomb is.
Wow. It's amazing to think about dogs being able to do their tasks with that sort of precision and correctness. I'm thinking about our older golden retriever who's 13 and has both failing eyesight and failing hearing, especially. But as far as we can tell, there's nothing yet wrong with her nose. She still seems to have a very, very good sense of smell. For the typical work dog doing this work for the military and law enforcement, what typically are the issues which lead to that dog having to retire from their work?
Well, because of it, because the work is so grueling, a lot of these dogs retire when they're 7 or 8 years old. 90% of the military working dogs are adopted by their trainers, and the other 10% are adopted out to carefully screen civilians, which there's a very long waiting list. I already checked. Sometimes dogs have injuries, like Leica, the dog on the cover. She was sniffing out an explosive. She was only on the job for 3 weeks. She was in Afghanistan, and she was leading her trainer, Julie McDonald, and his team, and a sniper shot her, and she lost her right front leg. So she went through many operations, and she was retired, but they were very the military was reluctant to give her to her trainer, who by this time was also retired. And he convinced them that, you know, she would transform into a great family dog, because he had a wife and a toddler. And with, you know, she went through a desensitization program, and he had a muzzle on her when she first met his young son, and he took it off after 5 minutes. She's perfectly fine. She's a real family dog. She does all kinds of activities with them, such as kayaking. And he actually refers to her as his fur daughter. And she too has a new career. She goes skydiving to test out parachute dog vests in tandem with him for the military. So she's still very active, and she can run like the wind, even though she is missing one of her front legs.
Wow. That's really something. By the way, most of the stories you've told have been either present-day stories or from the recent past. But if I remember correctly, there's at least one story that takes us all the way back to World War I.
Yes, I have five historic hounds that I've profiled, and Sergeant Stubby was a heroic dog in World War I. He was a pit bull mix and just an incredible dog. He served overseas in France. He sniffed out mustard bombs, because once he had been bombed, and the mustard gas stings the eyes and it burns the respiratory system, so he never forgot that smell. So when the bombs were being dropped from planes, he could sniff it way before the troops could. So he would lie down and put his paws over his nose to let everybody know that a gas attack was about to take place. So they quick put on the gas masks, and even he had a gas mask designed for his, you know, short, flat nose. He also sniffed out a German spy who was mapping the area. So he was just an incredible hero. I think someone needs to make a movie about that dog.
Well, this book is chock full of amazing and inspiring stories. And again, the book is called Paws of Courage, True Tales of Heroic Dogs That Protect and Serve. And it comes from the good people of the National Geographic Society and the author, Nancy Furstinger. Nancy Furstinger, I enjoyed speaking with you and enjoyed your book. Thank you so much, and very best wishes to you.
Thank you, and enjoy your golden retrievers.
Thank you. Again, this morning show conversation came from the morning show archives, as will our Monday morning show. Because of the recent death of James Levine, longtime music director of the Metropolitan Opera, we are replaying on Monday an intriguing conversation with Joanna Fiedler, daughter of Arthur Fiedler, the longtime conductor of the Boston Pops. Joanna Fiedler's book is called Molto Agitato, a behind-the-scenes look at the Metropolitan Opera, which includes a lengthy analysis of the influence of James Levine on the Metropolitan Opera. We'll replay that memorable conversation on Monday's morning show. Next week includes a visit from Art Sear on Tuesday's morning show, a look at the New York Mets on Wednesday. A novelist joins us on Thursday, and next Friday, a week from today, Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College, with both the executive director and chairperson of the Gateway Foundation. Support for the morning show comes from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, offering a master's degree in clinical mental health counseling. Work as a licensed professional counselor or mental health and wellness advocate. Details are available at uwp.edu. And we remind you that you can subscribe to The Morning Show as a podcast to enjoy a different morning show 7 days a week. Over the weekend, our podcast version will include a memorable conversation about the importance of CPR. Subscribe to The Morning